What's up, Alex Bivens, man? What's up? How are you, bro? How are you? Are you cool? I'm very cool, man.
I'm not sure. Chris, is that you?
Nah, not really, man. I'll tell you what happened. Okay.
Well, yeah, what okay, did happen? Because something happened. So,
listen, man. Listen.
I'm listening.
So, like, last week, right? Weekend was Memorial Day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yep. in a lot of places, man, Memorial Day is like, you know, beginning of summer, right?
Yeah, that's kinda. True. That's true. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Beginning
okay.
of summer. So around my house or my wife's house, who's you know what I'm talking about, the places here, right, man? In the summer, we watch our favorite summer movies, man.
Wow, okay.
And just before me and my wife, we caught Dazed and Confused.
Dazed and Confused.
Yeah, directed by Linklater. Yeah, you know what?
Okay.
If you were a certain age at a certain time in a certain place, this movie resonates. And I was that age at that time in that place, bro. Yeah.
Okay, well, Dazed and Confused, that was with Matthew McConaughey?
You know what? It started so many careers, man. Right? And that's the guy I'm imitating, Slater.
This dude,
man.
Right here.
Slater, yeah.
Slater with
his
the hat.
Entire role in the movie was to be the highest guy in the movie. He's so old. I remember you, man. We had geography together. Yeah. Check you later, man.
That was him, huh? That was.
Yeah. And, you know, Jovovich started there. Parker Posey was early in her career. Ben Affleck, very, very. I think he had done a Burger King commercial before that. And there's so many people. And there's my guy. And I was in eighth grade. About four or five people in the movie are playing eighth graders in 1976.
Oh, geez.
And the upperclassmen, like that guy wanna. They're gonna take the paddle to the eighth grader's ass as like they're new freshmen, so they get I don't know.
So wait a minute. There was Ben Affleck was in this.
Right.
Matthew McConaughey was in this.
Uh huh.
The guy who plays Slater was. Went on to play a lead character in the first season or two of CSI Miami.
Right, right.
Wow.
And there's Parker Posey, Jojovich, who wound up being.
That's McConaughey right there. We got a quick flash.
Yeah. That redhead is Ribisi, Giovanni Ribisi's sister. She did a bunch of stuff. Anyway.
So this is like the stoner version of American Graffiti, huh?
Yeah, very much so. And the kids who are like getting chased by Ben Affleck and stuff, they're in eighth grade in 1976. I was in eighth grade in 1976.
Wow.
The soundtrack, this is wall-to-wall 70s rock hits. Exactly what I grew up on. And it's just fun. I mean, they eventually have a beer blast out in the woods somewhere. My junior year, we had a beer blast, I don't know, some kind of field somewhere, you know. So, yes.
Want to admit this now.
Statutes of limitation is out, baby. That's
so you're saying that everybody, in terms of writer, producer, directors, actors, nailed it?
Absolutely nailed it. And that's why it's a perfect movie for summer dreaming. You know, come summer, you want to sit back, relax, and go to those go-to movies. You know,
yes.
The movie where it doesn't really matter how many times you've seen it, you're going to have a great time with it. And for me and for Tina, it must have been the weed, man. that movie just nails it, you know. I bet you have 10 or 12. I have 10 or 12 movies that are like, ah. Oh.
Yeah, well, you know, I actually, was it, I think Goonies was one of the movies that I enjoyed, you know, that came out during the summer.
That's another movie, chock full of future superstars.
Oh, yeah, was it Sean Astin?
Yeah, Samwise Gamgee. Yep, Thanos is in that movie.
Roland.
Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner? No.
So
wrong Roland.
what's his name? Brolin.
Josh Brolin. Thanos.
Josh, yes.
He went on to play Thanos, bro.
That's right. In the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That's right.
That's right.
You know, and that's a funny thing, too, because we can think about films. And by the way, folks, if you can't tell us, we're talking about films, you know, this time around.
We're starting the summer off right.
Yes.
By talking about sometimes, as writers, as creatives, you have to feed the muse, right?
Yep.
And the summertime is a great time to pile up some of your favorite treats and be good to yourself with some of your favorite summer movies.
And then also, you know, bro, we also talk about quite often on the show, we talk about how an era is reflected by the films and vice versa. So, you know, one channels the other. For instance, Jaws came out as a summer film.
Right.
And that had a whole impact. When it first came out, it did not explode at the box office.
Right.
But it grew on our consciousness, and eventually it's become this sort of classic in its own way that people constantly refer to. And partially because of how a limitation actually made it a better movie. Or we could say how, because of a limitation, the director became more creative and it made it a better movie.
True. So now, answering that, we're going to save Jaws for another episode. Or we're going to talk about Jaws now.
Well, I mean, you know, there's enough Jaws to talk about, but let's move on. Let's move on.
Well, I wanted to go back to Days of Confused to underscore
your
point.
Okay, go ahead.
As goofy as I was, and as, you know, rocking as the soundtrack is, and how, you know, it's just really about partying and have a good time on the surface, there's these conversations underneath. You know, some of them are just kids trying to have their first big idea. And that's a rite of passage. But also there's some of the jocks are struggling because they want the coaches want them to sign this behavior agreement that seems so much a 1950s agreement, and their sensibilities, you know, this is after the end of Vietnam. This is, again, there's a lot.
Was it set in 1976?
1976. So, yep, weed, beer, great music. Not really wanting to toe the line. It's kind of the end of that era. And so they deal with that kind of in the middle of all this, that idea of, you know, the bullies being assholes and getting their comeuppance and the kids trying to find their way. And there's a great ability Linkletter has to throw some ideas out there between the joints, dude, and the, you know, the weed jokes, dude. Some of it doesn't age that well.
Also,
what's his name? McConaughey. You know, he has that great line, "All right, all right, all right." That improv in that movie. But also, he's somewhere between 18 and 20. And he actually has the line in that movie. It's like, you know what I love is that I keep getting older and the high school girls keep staying the same age. Which does not ring the same way.
Yeah.
You know? So you take the good and the bad, or you take the good and the weird.
Now, you think that was a matter of not being conscious of the possible subtext?
Well, I think
meaning of that.
I think when it was made and when they were going with the context of 1976, you know, high school girls would be very interested in an 18, 19, 20 year old, you know, but I would say this today's generation of eight, you know, high school girls, they hear that kind of line and nah, you know, and even back then, Tina's not, you know, she's within my age range and she would never stand for that kind of, you know, so there, it wasn't like the women in the 70s were not
selective
or not liberated and they would, but it's 50 years later. I would hope we were further down the road, you know, and I'm glad that they are, you know. But yeah, it's interesting to see that going on. Jaws, did you want to talk about Jaws?
We're still with Days for a moment. So,
okay.
So part of what I'm hearing here, and again, this is sort of again a lesson at looking at material, you know, because some material does and doesn't fly, or doesn't age well, as you phrased it, when you go to look at a film or you go to read a certain book years later, you know. So yeah. as writers, should we be conscious of that, or should we be true to what we're thinking and what we're shooting for at that time?
I would say that if you try and consider every single person's possible objections, you're going to only be able to write a grocery list, and it will be a very truncated list at that. This was 1976. As much as Ben Affleck's character is a real sadomasochistic psych patient of a asshole, was very appropriate to that time and like the next 10 or 20 years. There's still some roaming around the high school.
Well, if you think about movies like Animal House and certain other films, even films made in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, there are constantly, when they have a college theme, there's constantly some reference to, or sometimes stories based on, hazing and college frat house activities that are not necessarily conducive to good health, safety, or emotional well-being.
And I think those are, again, of their time, accurate of their time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the filmmaker who is in college right now, or the screenwriter who is in college, or even the, you know, novelist or whatever who's in the mm-hmm. college right now, they're going to write a completely different experience. You know, there's going to be everyone's going to be a lot more at ease with diversity. The cast will be more diverse. We noticed, we went over the cast before the show, and it was diverse by two, right?
Yes,
two people
right.
of color. Two people of color.
That's dos people, right?
One was a teacher, had one scene, and the other was, you know, his 15th man in the cast or something, you know.
When was the movie made?
I think it was probably late 80s, early 90s, something like that. But it was reflected of 76.
Right. So it's a movie made in the 80s, but reflecting the 1970s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, okay. You know, a movie about graduating in 2023, it's going to be different. You know, they'll be mm-hmm. much more casual about LGBTQ relationships. Experimentation in that way, but they're still going to be jerks. They may be defined in a different way, you know. There just always is.
Being true to the era in which you are functioning, that unless you're doing a retro kind of film, in which case, yeah, you got to be true to that particular time period and influences.
But being true to yourself
as a writer and being true to the story that you're trying to tell at that time.
Yeah, I mean, you have to serve the story.
Yeah.
So Assholes Were Required in Dazed and Confused, as well as Slater, bro, because yeah. You know, he was very much indicative of that time and place.
Well, Slater, here, work with me here for a moment. What other films, let's see, came out at the summer? Because we still, you know, a little summer dreaming here.
Well, we talked a little bit about Jaws, and I think Jaws deserves a deeper dive, because it's there's so much in there that is creativity. You know, part of creativity is coming up with a great idea, and the other part is executing that idea despite everything that you come up against. In
okay,
the case
so
of Jaws,
yeah, there's
sharp,
Jaws, and then there's Dirty Dancing.
Yeah. Well, let's go. Let's hold on a second. Let's go to Jaws. The shark didn't work.
Yeah.
And they had to finish the film, and it led to some of the more creative moments. They hired, I'd have to do the research, but they hired some people to get, they had underwater footage of sharks, and included in there was that great part when the shark is trapped in the cage. If the shark was really working well, they wouldn't have ever gotten that, you know, that
right.
Footage.
So the footage that they got that you're talking about belonged to the people that they hired who had that footage.
Right.
Right. This was not shot for the movie.
They needed some shark footage because the mechanical shark wasn't doing it.
It wasn't making it.
And then it, you know, they had to improvise. So seeing the fin, seeing it underwater, of course the music, all of this, which was to overcompensate or to compensate for, I forget the character, the what they called the mechanical shark, or some kind of goofy name, Bud or something, Barney or something, to compensate for him not working or it not working, they came up with all these creative things that really wound up contributing to another classic piece of summer dreaming. This happens to be a nightmare, but every summer I have to see that movie.
You talked about certain scenes in Dazed and Confused that locked in with you. In Jaws, the first scene is probably, in terms of your imagination taking over, the first scene of that is probably the most powerful scene of the film.
And you know, a great segue.
For those of you who haven't seen it, too bad. Here we go. Here we go, right? Because you've got the lovely young lady in lovely bathing suit swimming in the calm water.
Well,
the
setup is another bunch of 70s kids or whatever sitting on the beach this time partying. They're smoking joints. They're drinking beers. And she runs off declothing, and a drunken guy trying to get over, he follows, and then she's in the water by herself because my man cannot get there.
Yep.
And then what happens?
Something else good. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing that's most disturbing about it is we don't see it.
No.
We don't see it. You know, and the way that she is affected by her reactions and all of that is what makes it even scarier. And I think, again, there are certain scenes in certain films, including one 1950s film that is so bad. I mean, it's so bad. But it has one powerful scene where it's so powerful because you don't see the thing. You realize someone's in danger or being attacked, but it's off camera, and it's their reactions or the sounds that you hear that cause your mind to go, oh, whoa, ooh, wow.
What movie are we talking about from the Alex Simmons time machine?
You know, I honestly, it is so bad that I don't remember the name of it, but I could look it up. But it's a film about a scientist who is trying to create some sort of cure for a blood disease and stupidly uses some sort of bat serum and doesn't become Batman. You know, he goes in the other direction and becomes a vampire. And it's because of the serum. So it's not supernatural. And it's I think it was, you know, it was the 1950s. 1950s were not known for a plethora of high budget B-minus films. And this film in particular was like really low. No. I think a few friends got together with $175.
Yeah, they were known for low budget.
Yeah, and had an evening.
Low budget.
They had an
drive-in movie type.
I think it was Friday night to Saturday afternoon. They had some time to shoot a movie, and they had an outdoor balcony, and they had a basement to work with, and they maximized that. But there's a scene where the scientist is already turned into the vampire. We don't really get to see him too much in this moment in the film. But his assistant, foolishly enough, is alone in the basement working on the experiment, an experiment. And again, high budget here. We've got an overhanging lamp that's casting a pool of light onto a small workbench. So the rest of the room is in darkness. And the assistant is leaning into the light, sitting on a stool. And we know the creature, the scientist, the vampire is coming through the darkness. What? And suddenly the guy is grabbed from behind and pulled out of the light. And it's his pleading. It's the scuffle sounds, and then suddenly the pleading, the actors voicing, begging for help that creeps you out. And you never see anything, just that.
So is that a summer gem for you? A bit of
no, dreaming? No. I refuse to go look at that film again. But I'm saying that scene has stayed with me for years, because it's very much indicative of, like we were talking about with Jaws, of having very little to work with. And I think in this case, it was the actor who helped make the moment work.
Yeah.
Because if
I'm surprised that the actor
did, it would not have worked. It would have just been, oh, yank, I can't see anything, who cares?
Yeah. I'm surprised they didn't hit the overhead lamp and have the swinging. So it's
no, because then you would have probably seen the rest of the set, and that would not have been right.
Set was only 4 feet wide.
Yeah, so really. I think we got to keep this really centralized here. But again, what we're talking about is, and it was a summer movie. It was a movie I saw during the summer when I was a kid. We're talking about the kinds of films that people tend to either deliver to the populace, the audience, or the audience goes for, or in your case, goes back to summer after summer, right? Yeah. So we mentioned Dazed and Confused. We mentioned Jaws.
Dazed and Confused. And remember, today's menu of films do not have to be classics.
No, this is true.
We may stumble onto a classic, but as long as, I have to see that sometime during the summer.
Well, let's move away from high school teens, but we can stay near water with this one, Deliverance.
Oh, bro. Yo, man, they didn't have as much fun at their party. They didn't, man.
That was a bit of a bummer.
There's some locals just harsh in their mellow. Really, bro. That's what I'm saying. Deliverance. I tell you what.
Based on Deliverance, the novel by James Dickey.
A James Dickey, a great novel by James Dickey and all that stuff. But when I saw it, and again, we're still in the Alex Simmons time machine. So anyone who's under 100 is like, what the hell? Go ahead. YouTube it. Find out a little
YouTube,
bit.
Chris.
Just watch the trailer. The thing that we remember from that, the shocker, the big, huge thing, is these guys are doing whitewater rafting.
Yeah, it's a bunch of ordinary guys decide to go on a weekend trip to be men, sort of, and a couple of them are like very much average white collar guys, never been in the woods kind of stuff. And one
Not
guy,
Burt Reynolds.
Yeah, you got Burt Reynolds who had been,
And they rode up against some rednecks who,
let's just say, it's not so much that they're rednecks, is that they are people who have
they've been up in them hills.
The hills have eyes,
I tell you what,
you don't want these eyes looking at you,
you you think as a kid, because we, you know, we unknowingly saw this movie. We, you know, the trailer just shows you the whitewater rafting and a bow and arrow, and you think there's going to be some, you know, great action. And all of a sudden, you're watching it, and Ned Beatty, one of the great character actors. Yeah, there's the trailer.
There's Ned.
But Ned winds up. Ned winds up getting raped.
Yeah.
By some mountain men. And what was that's.
It's Ned Beatty. It's Burt Reynolds. It's John Voight.
John Voight is the other one. And I forget the fourth one.
In the rafter there. Yeah. They get caught. Ned Beatty and John Voight get caught by some hillbilly gentlemen who are just, you know, they
not picky. They're not picky.
No, no, they're not. You know, and there's a line where, you know, in another movie where they're talking about this movie, and the guy says, you know, I can understand how the guy might, you know, want to play for the other side, but wouldn't you have waited for Burt Reynolds to come down the river?
Or John Burt Lloyd. But, you know, Ned, God bless Ned. You know, they not only did they rape him, but they humiliated him as well. They said he had pretty lips. And they made him squeal like a pig.
Yep.
And then rolled him, got him naked and rolled him in the mud, made him squeal like a pig while, you know, just off camera, you kind of know what's happening.
Yeah.
And I was not really aware of that being the kind of material you could have in a movie.
When you saw it?
When I saw it, I was...
How old are you?
It had whatever year that movie came out. I think that was in the 70s.
Yep. I can tell you. 19. Oh, come on now. Be nice. 72.
72. So I probably didn't see it at age 10. I was 10 in 72.
I wasn't.
No, you were not. but I probably saw it shown somewhere still in the 70s, somewhere, you know, and I remember the visceral shock of that scene, which is, I mean, that was the point, that they were not prepared for what happened. And then the fallout of that was the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
And Ned Beatty was fantastic. And the rest, you know, they each had a different reaction to it. One being, you know, Burt Reynolds was the Uberman revenge guy. But Ned fell apart, you know. I didn't expect this movie to come up in this conversation. And I will not go back to Slater for it because I don't know what he would do.
yeah, well, you did enough for it in the beginning. Yeah, it's the kind of
so yeah, we can go on to a fourth one if you want.
Yeah, well, yeah, I can tell that you're uncomfortable, and that's all right.
Well, I mean, all I remember from that movie, because I don't remember even where I saw it, but I was still pretty young, is that, you know, that it's scene.
There's the dueling banjo scene.
Dueling banjos, scene,
which is really okay. So what we can take from the film, other than that moment, which is very shocking, is that the story is really about the death of a community in a town, in an era and a way of life, because that's what's happening to this era, this area, is this town, this region, this community is being bulldozed for a new development.
Right.
So the old ways of these people who had lived in this, I think it was Appalachia, lived in this this area for generations, everything was now going to change. Everything was gone. And in a way, they had been brutalized. And so to some degree, it's about the loss of. And it's a very intense film. And I'm sure the book is probably better, because quite often that's the case. Although this film was quite impactful and well done.
Let me ask you a question.
Maybe took more time to actually reflect on that.
Yeah.
You know.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
In 2023,
mm-hmm.
could you do the dueling banjo scene?
I think that
that's in that movie clearly to foreshadow that you're not in Kansas anymore.
I think you could. I think you absolutely could. I think there are probably, you know, that, and it's a question that if I thought of it ahead of time, I would have been better prepared to answer. But I'm sure there are examples of things just like that. Because in effect, what it did, because one of the things is the boy, it's a young boy playing the banjo so expertly. He's maybe
yes, but that boy is special needs boy.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I'm saying. Clear. Yeah, you can do it now. I think what it was is it was showing, in a way, it was showing you that a person of that community with special abilities, but also special needs. And you're looking at what the community had to offer and now can't even do that.
I will respectfully say I read that scene completely differently.
Ah, yeah, well.
I read that as.
You read that
foreshadowing as. That they were in a weird place. Ah. The way they shot that kid, the way that they angled his face to exaggerate his features to a certain degree. There wasn't applause at the end. There wasn't congratulations. There wasn't celebration of the kid. It was used as a, you know, if you're going into the woods and all of a sudden you see all these animal skeletons and all that. So, you know, it was that kind of, in my view.
And I don't disagree with you in that the way it's shot, there is no great, fantastic kind of thing, because there's a certain loss of innocence between the boy and the adult, because the adult who's with Burt Reynolds and his boys, the adult who's playing the guitar trying to keep up with the boy, is very, you know, he's a family man. He's looking at this boy and thinking about his own kids, and what happens to him in the film is another tragedy. But the reality to me is that there's vulnerability here, and there's this lifestyle that this what this child has to offer is all this child has to offer, and has nowhere to take it. And
well, it does show the power of the native residents. We'll use that term native loosely, because they, of course, if you ever heard Dueling Banjos, it starts very slowly, and it's the kid who keeps pulling, you know, up in the ante until, I mean, he's just blazing.
Yep.
You know, not in Slater's way, bro.
Yeah.
And he just has that laugh at the end, you know. I think that it would require a different ending of that scene. And I don't know if people would be comfortable with the way it was used, that you are underestimating where you are. You know, how about the Ned Beatty scene?
Well, we've talked about that.
But could you do that in 2023?
Yeah, and you do it. But what they tend to do it is they do it in prison films more. Matter of fact, I was watching some clips from a prison film just this morning. And yeah, that's a big part of it. So, you know.
Well, yes, but this was, you know, again, this was a commentary on the region they were in and how much danger they were in.
And I would.
I wonder, I don't know. Maybe you could get away with it.
I would challenge to say that if someone wanted to do it now, they could and would. How people reacted to it it depends on the story and how it's set up. And again, our summer conversation is going a little bit into.
Yeah, I just for the record, no. That is not a movie that I return to.
That's because we're staying on it so long. That's because we're staying on. So if we move on to another.
Gladly.
Yeah, we move on to another film.
It is a great film. I would never watch it a second time.
Well, I feel the same way about Seven, and we're not going to talk about that one now. So So we had American Graffiti, which we mentioned, which reminded me a little bit of Dazed and Confused in certain ways. How about
do you rewatch American Graffiti?
I've watched it maybe three times.
Okay, so
three times.
So we're talking about the ones we look for or look forward to revisiting.
Right.
Especially Goonies. During the summertime.
Goonies is one that I revisit.
Which one?
Goonies.
Goonies. Goonies is one you revisit.
Yeah. And we know,
I didn't see that movie until I was much, much older. Matter of fact, because there was so many people in that movie,
Tina and I sat down and watched it.
Really?
Kind of like completing, you know, filling out a missing spot in your education. Yeah, so I didn't.
Well, again, you know, Goonies is a film, and again, for those of you who don't know it, and we'll keep it light. Goonies is a light film. It's a lighthearted film. It's a silly film. It's about a bunch of kids living in a sea coastal town, which is also going through some struggles, but not as deeply as the other film we talked about. And they go on a treasure hunt for pirate treasure in a cave underneath the town, and all kinds of bizarre and strange and fantastic things happen. And there's crooks following them, and there's all kinds of stuff. And it's a great, fun, it's almost like Indiana Jones, but for kids, you know?
Right, definitely.
It's that kind of feel to it. It's got boys and girls, they're going through this stuff. There's all these different personalities are coming from it. And in terms of the actors, there's an older brother in the scene, in the group, and that's played by Josh Brolin, a young Josh Brolin, pre-Young Riders, isn't it, if I remember right?
Right.
Sean Astin is in it, and people are going, right.
So
Astin?
Josh Brolin goes on to be Thanos.
Right. Sean Astin goes on to be?
Samwise Gamgee.
Right.
In the Lord of the Rings movies, the original Lord of the trilogy. Rings,
right. Now, Sean's done a bunch of other things, so some of you will know Sean.
Rudy.
Rudy in Stranger Things.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yes, nicely done, sir. Yes, nicely done.
Yes.
Oh, extra, so some folks will know him from Gryffindor.
That. And when stuff happened to him in Stranger Things, I was pissed.
That's true.
I was like, real. Oh,
you know,
no.
He was a very likable character there.
Right, and then we have a young actor who in the Indiana Jones film, I think it was the third one.
Second one.
Yeah, in the second one, Indiana, he played Short Run.
Right.
But he is, and then he sort of like disappeared for a while.
Right.
You know,
until recently.
Went away from acting. And by the way, his name is, and I'm going to do it wrong. Please forgive me, folks. It's Ke-Hui Quan. It's K-E space H-U-Y space Q-U-A-N.
Right.
And he went on to most recently in a wonderful film, and I'm going to get this wrong too, but we're going to try with Everything Everywhere.
All at once.
Yeah, All at Once. Yeah.
Which just cleaned up at the Oscars last time around.
Everything Everywhere All at Once. Yeah. This is his comeback film.
It was his comeback film. Yeah. And one of the people that helped him somehow connect with that was one of the kids who was in Goonies, the heavyset Chunk, I think was his name, his character's name, who is now like his lawyer or something like that.
I'm trying to remember the actor's name. Oh my goodness, come on. We'll have to look up Chunk.
Yeah, but
Chunk's mother was played by Elaine Cohen. Why don't I see? I found Sloth.
It wasn't Sloth, it was Chunk.
Where the heck is Chunk? Oh, here he is. Chunk. Oh, my goodness. Jeff Cohen.
Yes, so Jeff Cohen eventually.
Does not look chunky at all.
No, I think he's a lawyer or an agent of some kind, but he was connected with Key and getting somehow. That was one of the things he mentioned in his interviews. So I was like, wow, that's pretty fun, too.
And another name that people will probably know is Corey Feldman.
Yep.
You know, so he was one of the kids in that. And Carrie Green, which I didn't follow her career, so I'm not quite sure about that. Joe Palatoliano, who has done a number of films,
the one I was watching the other day. But he was in The Sopranos. He was in Midnight Run. He was the bail bondsman.
He was in The Fugitive
We're really hitting the Wayback Machine for everybody.
Yeah, we are.
But that's okay. That's okay.
This is the beauty of it. But again, so Goonies was a fun film because it was pure, when I say fantasy, I don't mean, you know, elves and things like that. It's a fantastic, fictional, fantastic fantasy type of adventure story for kids, with kids coming out on top, you know, against all odds, of figuring out how to hang together, work together, what their relationships are with each other. And overcoming, you know, not only quote unquote evil in terms of our bad guys, but also, you know, in its subtle way, Sloth, which was this huge person,
kind of a cuttable Cuddly? Yeah, kind of a cuddly Cyclops.
Well, yeah, he had his face was deformed.
Right.
Was bloated on one side, you know, and lived underneath the town. I won't go into the whole story. But
again, the kids, clearly a special needs person.
Yeah, the kids encounter him initially as a threat, but soon one of them sees him as basically a potential friend, and they connect. And at the end of the film, there's a nice moment, you know, with them. So, you know, there's a lot of little elements going on in this film that were fun and exciting. And yes, I do get a kick out of it occasionally going back there. It's like the Little Rascals meet Indiana Jones.
Yeah. So I was thinking while we were in the Wayback Machine, I was thinking, well, what would young people, young 20-somethings and younger, what would they kind of jump on for the summer? And I think for a lot of them, I think probably rewatching Stranger Things or binging something like that, or Marvel movies or some of the Marvel shows and stuff. But this week, and we were just talking before the show, that you and I both have different plans to see this movie on Tuesday.
Yep.
There is a new movie coming out that I think is going to capture a lot of people's like, oh, that was a great summer movie. And that's Spider-Man Across the Universe.
Yep.
The first film, yes, it's animated, but it's film to me. And I've even heard it described as the perfect superhero movie, but it was just a superb, superb movie. And I can't wait to see it. I think it's going to be another edition of those. Oh, look, let's check this out tonight. Let's see this movie, you know?
Well, you know, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it. The first one was great. It had heart. It had a message. It had adventure and excitement. It was visually.
It had Miles.
Excuse me?
It had Miles Morales.
Yep. I mean, it was diverse. It had so many wonderful, delicious things that were great about it. And so I'm definitely looking forward to seeing this film. And I think that, you know, it's funny because sometimes people say, well, you know, where people are right now, and this is really one of the reasons that I wanted to do this segment. So where people are right now, you know, we're in a different place, different headspace. We're not susceptible to this. We're not interested in that. This downer here, downer there. I think, you know, as people, we're always looking for entertainment. We're always looking to feel like we belong somewhere, or we want to escape from somewhere, or we feel the need for some excitement, something positive. You know, we want to see things that are going to make us smile or feel better about things. And I think that, you know, there's room, always room for movies like that. And I think that this is one of those movies which, even, you know, it's got bad guys and stuff in it, but it doesn't have that negative, oppressive pall that seems to hang over so many other films.
True.
And I think that's one of the reasons the first one did as well as it did too. There was definitely was a message in there. There were dramatic moments, if you will.
Right.
But there was always this energy and this fact that, yes, we're going to keep moving forward. We're going to somehow get through this. We're going to somehow come together and win. And I think that's, you know, I'm hoping that the second film has the same feeling.
How are we doing on time?
We got about 5 more minutes.
Cool. Can I make a kind of a left turn?
Sure.
One of the things I'm doing. There you go. Let's do this first.
Yeah. Okay.
There it is. Spider-Guy.
Yep.
Spider-Gwen. Miles Morales. Spider-Gwen. Spider-Man 2099. All sorts of different Spideys.
Yep. You got it. But anyway,
I wanted to make a sharp left.
Yep.
One of the things I decided to do for this summer was read a bunch of great movies.
Read a bunch of great movies. Okay.
So every once in a while when, you know, the brain has been going all day and I just want to kind of relax, I'll kind of YouTube it and just tap in different things and see what shows up, right? So this led me to Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right? Of
great writer.
West Wing fame, right? But Few Good Men, The Trial of the Chicago 7, on and on, right?
Not to mention Newsroom.
Newsroom, yeah. Great stuff. One of the great monologues there. He was talking, and I love watching writers in interview settings or teachable moment settings. And he was talking about the two things you need in every scene. Just two. The two things you need in every scene is intention and obstacle, right? And in talking about his process and all that sort of stuff and his passionate allegiance to intention and opposition or obstacle, he talked about William Goldman, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Princess Bride, on and on, All the President's Men. And I said, you know what? Watching the films is one thing. I wonder if they have any of this. And I had a couple of gift certificates, you know, so from like my birthday months ago, right? And by the way, happy birthday to Alex Simmons. June 1st, everybody. It's not too late to just swarm him with happy birthday because he deserves it.
Thank you.
So I indulged in searching to see if they had
Screenplays
published. William Goldman has one called Four Screenplays. Butch Cassidy, Princess Bride, boom, boom. And then another one, Five, right? This is the guy who, if you're a screenwriter or a writer in general, and if you haven't read Adventures in the Screen Trade, fix that. That's by William Goldman. Mm-hmm. And what I have discovered, because I started with William Goldman, and I got the first volume of West Wing, The Trial of the Chicago 7, and something else by Aaron Sorkin. So I'm going to read both, but I started with William Goldman, and he is witty and insightful in his introductions to each film. He talks about, here's one little throwaway. He talks about how everybody, all film lovers, get it wrong when it comes to reshoots. Especially like the press and everything. They say, oh, this movie's in trouble. It's getting reshoots. He says, nah, that's not a sign that it's in trouble. If they just rush it out on some dead weekend and let it die, that's when the film is in trouble. If they're still spending money on it, that means they believe in the film. They think they have a hit on their hands and they're making some minor adjustments to just bring it all the way to the end. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. And that kind of stuff is fascinating. So you get all those insights and then you get to read the actual scripts. And there's two things I've already learned. And again, this is my offering to those who are listening. Grab some great scripts. You know, I know you can get Avengers Infinity War and Endgame somewhere online. Right. And those are the same thing happens here. Every line, it's not direction heavy. It's not big parallel, you know, boom, 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 but it's dialogue and it's, you can hear intention and opposition or intention and obstacle. Yes. But one of the things I'm noticing is besides the forward movement, the amazing energy of the forward movement, the dialogue is short and punchy. And I immediately took that and started looking at my short stories, my prose short stories. Is there a way to make each line a little shorter, a little punchier? And that's the kind of thing that you get out of a summer project, like summer dreaming, sitting back and enjoying your very favorite summer movies, or for this summer, summer reading. My summer reading assignment is going to be William Goldman, about 10 of his movies, and equal number of things from Aaron Sorkin. And
read The Social Network too.
Yeah, I haven't got my hands on that yet. And that's not my favorite movie, but I want to read it. Yeah. You know? Yeah. All the President's Men. A Few Good Men. Definitely want to read it. I wonder if there's a difference between the play and the movie, but
you know, it's funny you mentioned that because, and I, again, we're trying to wind up here, but I will just mention among my students, one of the things that I give them to read and to watch is 12 Angry Men. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is going back in my Wayback Machine, folks. I'm talking about the 1957 version film, the film feature as opposed to the 1997 made-for-TV movie.
Yeah.
But I've got the screenplay for the 57 film, and reading that and then watching the film is very intriguing, because there's ways that the screenwriter has envisioned certain scenes,
right,
and set up for certain scenes, which is not the way they were shot.
Right.
But dialogue-wise, a lot of that is almost on the money.
Yep.
And I think that where things were changed is might have been, and I wasn't there, because in 57 I was not there. I was here in the world, but I was not there. Some of it might have been things that were developed by the actors and the director as they were working on the piece. And then the last thing I'll say is there's definitely subtle differences between the film version and the play.
Yeah.
Right. And again, what that seems to me to be, something I've seen in other productions, is when a new group of creatives get their hands on something that they respect. I'm not talking about they go, oh, let me just do this. But they respect the material. They respect the source material. But they want to expand on, or they see a slightly different interpretation on a moment here or there, or they want to bring something forward a little bit more in this medium than it was in that medium, then yes, there'll be changes, there'll be differences.
Right. I like the novel to the play to the movie of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Three very different and fascinating versions of the same story.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I'm thinking about with this 12 Angry Men, Sorkin wrote The Trial of the Chicago Seven, which I believe you can still see on Netflix.
Yep, and I got a copy of it here.
A comparative analysis of how they handled issues in 12 Angry Men, how they handle issues in the Trial of the Chicago Seven. Because as much as they're both very different projects, there are a couple of themes that run through both.
Mm-hmm.
And fascinating.
Yeah.
You know?
One more additive. There is a movie called 12, which I am not sure how one pronounces it in its native language, which is Russian. But it is a Russian adaptation, present day, of 12 Angry Men.
Fascinating.
Yes.
In Russia.
Yes.
It's set in Russia.
It's got issues that are indigenous to that region. And it's fascinating. Fascinating.
So our point here today, well, first we wanted to have some fun.
Yes,
and then we wanted to encourage you to go and find your summer dreaming.
Yep.
And, you know, replenish your muse, you know, feed the muse, keep the fuel of enjoying these things and maybe looking at them another time. And what did you see? How did this work? What, you know, what stands up to time? What has kind of rung different because of the times you're in? How does the dialogue work, or the pacing work, or the shots work for you? And how can that help your storytelling? And then sometimes approach a medium from a different angle. You know, listen to a movie. You know, what special effects do they put in there? What's the, you know, listening to Jaws, for example, you see how important the music is. You know, listening to Dazed and Confused, you see how much music was a part of that era. It depends on whether you're familiar with the music or not, whether you enjoy it. But it's just wall to wall. And that's true to the culture of that time. I wonder what the equivalent would be today. But reading a movie is a completely different experience that you can learn a lot from. And all of it is tied into something that we're going to be repeating and revisiting from different angles all summer. Summer dreaming.
Right. There you go.
It's another way to tell your damn story, folks.
And on that note, folks, we will say fun farewell for now.
And dudes, we'll check you later, dudes.
Take care, Chris. Bye-bye, everybody.
Later.